manufacturing period. The various operations that are performed in turns by the producer of a commodity and coalesce one with another during the progress of production lay claim to him in various ways. In one operation he must exert more strength, in another more skill, in another more attention, and the same individual does not possess all these qualities in an equal degree. After manufacture has once separated, made independent, and isolated the various operations, the labourers are divided, classified, and grouped according to their predominating qualities. If their natural endowments are, on the one hand, the foundation on which the division of labour is built up, on the other hand, manufacture, once introduced, develops in them new powers that are by nature fitted only for limited and special functions. The collective labourer now possesses, in an equal degree of excellence, all the qualities requisite for production, and expends them in the most economical manner by exclusively employing all his organs, consisting of particular labourers or groups of labourers, in performing their special functions. Footnote. The master manufacturer, by dividing the work to be executed into different processes, each requiring different degrees of skill or of force, can purchase exactly that precise quantity of both, which is necessary for each process. Whereas, if the whole work were executed by one workman, that person must possess sufficient skill to perform the most difficult, and sufficient strength to execute the most laborious of the operations into which the article is divided. Charles Babbage. End of footnote. The one-sidedness and the deficiencies of the detail labourer become perfections when he is a part of the collective labourer. Footnote. For instance, abnormal development of some muscles, curvature of bones, etc. End of footnote. The habit of doing only one thing converts him into a never-failing instrument, while his connection with the whole mechanism compels him to work with the regularity of the parts of a machine. Footnote. The question put by one of the inquiry commissioners, how the young persons are kept steadily to their work, is very correctly answered by Mr. William Marshall, the general manager of a glass manufactory. They cannot well neglect their work. When they once begin, they must go on. They are just the same as parts of a machine. Children's Employment Commission, 4th Report, 1865. End of footnote. Since the collective labourer has functions both simple and complex, both high and low, his members, the individual labour powers, require different degrees of training, and must therefore have different values. Manufacture, therefore, develops a hierarchy of labour powers, to which there corresponds a scale of wages. If, on the one hand, the individual labourers are appropriated and annexed for life by a limited function, on the other hand, the various operations of the hierarchy are parcelled out among the labourers according to both their natural and their acquired capabilities. Footnote. Dr. Ure, in his Apotheosis of Modern Mechanical Industry, brings out the peculiar character of manufacture more sharply than previous economists, who had not his polemical interest in the matter, and more sharply even than his contemporaries Babbage, for example, who, though much his superior as a mathematician and mechanician, treated mechanical industry from the standpoint of manufacture alone. Ure says, this appropriation, to each a workman of appropriate value and cost was naturally assigned, forms the very essence of division of labour. On the other hand, he describes this division as adaptation of labour to the different talents of men, and lastly, characterises the whole manufacturing system as a system for the division or gradation of labour, as the division of labour into degrees of skill, etc. Ure. End of footnote. Every process of production, however, requires certain simple manipulations, which every man is capable of doing. They, too, are now severed from their connection with the more pregnant moments of activity, and ossified into exclusive functions of specially appointed labourers. Hence, manufacture begets, in every handicraft that it seizes upon, a class of so-called unskilled labourers, a class which handicraft industry strictly excluded. If it develops a one-sided speciality into a perfection at the expense of the whole of a man's working capacity, it also begins to make a speciality of the absence of all development. Alongside of the hierarchic gradation, there steps the simple separation of the labourers into skilled and unskilled. For the latter, the cost of apprenticeship vanishes. For the former, it diminishes compared with that of artificers, in consequence of the functions being simplified. In both cases, the value of labour power falls. Footnote. Each handicraftsman being enabled to perfect himself by practice in one point became a cheaper workman. End of footnote. An exception to this law holds good whenever the decomposition of the labour process begets new and comprehensive functions that either had no place at all, or only a very modest one, in handicrafts. The fall in the value of labour power, caused by the disappearance or diminution of the expenses of apprenticeship, implies a direct increase of surplus value for the benefit of capital. For everything that shortens the necessary labour time required for the reproduction of labour power extends the domain of surplus labour. Section 4. Division of labour in manufacture and division of labour in society. We first considered the origin of manufacture, then its simple elements, then the detail labourer and his implements, and finally, the totality of the mechanism. We shall now lightly touch upon the relation between the division of labour in manufacture and the social division of labour, which forms the foundation of all production of commodities. If we keep labour alone in view, we may designate the separation of social production into its main divisions or genera, viz. Agriculture, industries, etc., as division of labour in general, and the splitting up of these families into species and subspecies, as division of labour in particular, and the division of labour within the workshop, as division of labour in singular or in detail. Footnote. Division of labour proceeds from the separation of professions the most widely different to that division, where several labourers divide between them the preparation of one and the same product, as in manufacture. Storch, Cours d'économie politique. Among peoples which have reached a certain level of civilization, we meet with three kinds of division of labour. The first, which we shall call general, brings about the division of the producers into agriculturalists, manufacturers, and traders. It corresponds to the three main branches of the nation's labour. The second, which one could call particular, is the division of labour of each branch into species. The third division of labour, which one could designate as a division of tasks, or of labour properly so called, is that which grows up in the individual crafts and trades, which is established in the majority of the manufactories and workshops. Scarbeck. End of footnote. Division of labour in a society, and a corresponding tying down of individuals to a particular calling, develops itself, just as does the division of labour in manufacture, from opposite starting points. Within a family, and after further development within a tribe, there springs up naturally a division of labour, caused by differences of sex and age, a division that is consequently based on purely physiological foundation, which division enlarges its materials by the expansion of the community, by the increase of population, and more especially by the conflicts between different tribes and the subjugation of one tribe by another. Footnote. Note to the third edition. Subsequent very searching study of the primitive condition of man led the author to the conclusion that it was not the family that originally developed into the tribe, but that, on the contrary, the tribe was the primitive and spontaneously developed form of human association, on the basis of blood relationship, and that out of the first incipient loosening of the tribal bonds, the many and various forms of the family were afterwards developed. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. On the other hand, as I have before remarked, the exchange of products springs up at the points where different families, tribes, communities come in contact. For in the beginning of civilization, it is not private individuals, but families, tribes, etc., that meet on an independent footing. Different communities find different means of production and different means of subsistence in their natural environment. Hence, their modes of production and of living and their products are different. It is this spontaneously developed difference which, when different communities come in contact, calls forth the mutual exchange of products and the consequent gradual conversion of those products into commodities. Exchange does not create the differences between the spheres of production, but brings what are already different into relation, and thus converts them into more or less interdependent branches of the collective production of an enlarged society. In the latter case, the social division of labour arises from the exchange between spheres of production that are originally distinct and independent of one another. In the former, where the physiological division of labour is the starting point, the particular organs of a compact whole grow loose and break off, principally owing to the exchange of commodities with foreign communities, and then isolate themselves so far that the sole bond, still connecting the various kinds of work, is the exchange of the products as commodities. In the one case, it is the making dependent what was before independent. In the other case, the making independent what was before dependent. The foundation of every division of labour that is well developed and brought about by the exchange of commodities is the separation between town and country. Footnote. Sir James Stewart is the economist who has handled this subject best. How little his book, which appeared 10 years before The Wealth of Nations, is known, even at the present time, may be judged from the fact that the admirers of Malthus do not even know that the first edition of the latter's work on population contains, except in the purely declamatory part, very little but extracts from Stuart, and in a less degree, from Wallace and Townsend. End of footnote. It may be said that the whole economic history of society is summed up in the movement of this antithesis. We pass it over, however, for the present. Just as a certain number of simultaneously employed labourers are the material prerequisites for division of labour in manufacture, so are the number and density of the population, which here correspond to the agglomeration in one workshop, a necessary condition for the division of labour in society. Footnote. There is a certain density of population which is convenient both for social intercourse and for that combination of powers by which the produce of labour is increased. James Mill. As the number of labourers increases, the productive power of society augments in the compound ratio of that increase multiplied by the effects of the division of labour. Thomas Hodgkin. End of footnote. Nevertheless, this density is more or less relative. A relatively thinly populated country with well-developed means of communication has a denser population than a more numerously populated country with badly developed means of communication. And in this sense, the northern states of the American Union, for instance, are more thickly populated than India. Footnote. In consequence of the great demand for cotton after 1861, the production of cotton in some thickly populated districts of India was extended at the expense of rice cultivation. In consequence, there arose local famines, the defective means of communication not permitting the failure of rice in one district to be compensated by importation from another. End of footnote. Since the production and the circulation of commodities are the general prerequisites of the capitalist mode of production, division of labour in manufacture demands that division of labour in society at large should previously have attained a certain degree of development. Inversely, the former division reacts upon and develops and multiplies the latter. Simultaneously, with the differentiation of the instruments of labour, the industries that produce these instruments become more and more differentiated. Footnote. Thus, the fabrication of shuttles formed as early as the 17th century, a special branch of industry in Holland. End of footnote. If the manufacturing system seize upon an industry which previously was carried on in connection with others, either as a chief or as a subordinate industry, and by one producer, these industries immediately separate their connection and become independent. If it seize upon a particular stage in the production of a commodity, the other stages of its production become converted into so many independent industries. It has already been stated that where the finished article consists merely of a number of parts fitted together, the detail operations may re-establish themselves as genuine and separate handicrafts. In order to carry out more perfectly the division of labour in manufacture, a single branch of production is, according to the varieties of its raw material or the various forms that one and the same raw material may assume, split up into numerous and, to some extent, entirely new manufactures. Accordingly, in France alone, in the first half of the 18th century, over 100 different kinds of silk stuffs were woven, and in Avignon it was law that every apprentice should devote himself to only one sort of fabrication, and should not learn the preparation of several kinds of stuff at once. The territorial division of labour which confines special branches of production to special districts of a country acquires fresh stimulus from the manufacturing system, which exploits every special advantage. Footnote. Whether the woollen manufacture of England is not divided into several parts or branches appropriated to particular places, where they are only or principally manufactured. Fine cloths in Somersetshire, coarse in Yorkshire, long ells at Exeter, soies at Sudbury, crepes at Norwich, linseys at Kendal, blankets at Whitney, and so forth. Barclay, the Querist, 1751, end of footnote. The colonial system and the opening out of the markets of the world, both of which are included in the general conditions of existence of the manufacturing period, furnish rich material for developing the division of labour in society. It is not the place here to go on to show how division of labour seizes upon not only the economic, but every other sphere of society, and everywhere lays the foundation of that all-engrossing system of specialising and sorting men, that development in a man of one single faculty at the expense of all other faculties, which caused A. Ferguson, the master of Adam Smith, to exclaim, "We make a nation of helots, and have no free citizens." Footnote. A. Ferguson, History of Civil Society, Edinburgh, 1767. End of footnote. But in spite of the numerous analogies and links connecting them, division of labour in the interior of a society and that in the interior of a workshop differ not only in degree, but also in kind. The analogy appears most indisputable where there is an invisible bond uniting the various branches of trade. For instance, the cattle breeder produces hides, the tanner makes the hides into leather, and the shoemaker the leather into boots. Here the thing produced by each of them is but a step towards the final form, which is the product of all their labours combined. There are, besides, all the various industries that supply the cattle breeder, the tanner, and the shoemaker with the means of production. Now it is quite possible to imagine, with Adam Smith, that the difference between the above social division of labour and the division in manufacture is merely subjective, exists merely for the observer, who, in a manufacture, can see with one glance all the numerous operations being performed on one spot, while in the instance given above, the spreading out of the work over great areas and the great number of people employed in each branch of labour obscure the connection. Footnote. In manufacture proper, he says, the division of labour appears to be greater because those employed in every different branch of the work can often be collected into the same workhouse and placed at once under the view of the spectator. In those great manufactures, on the contrary, which are destined to supply the great wants of the great body of the people, every different branch of the work employs so great a number of workmen that it is impossible to collect them all into the same workhouse. The division is not near so obvious. A. Smith, Wealth of Nations. The celebrated passage in the same chapter that begins with the words, "Observe the accommodation of the most common artificer or day-labourer in a civilised and thriving country," etc., and then proceeds to depict what an enormous number and variety of industries contribute to the satisfaction of the wants of an ordinary labourer, is copied almost word for word from B. de Mandeville's remarks to his Fable of the Bees, or Private Vices, Public Benefits, 1714, end of footnote. But what is it that forms the bond between the independent labours of the cattle breeder, the tanner, and the shoemaker? It is the fact that their respective products are commodities. What, on the other hand, characterises division of labour in manufactures? The fact that the detail labourer produces no commodities. Footnote. There is no longer anything which we can call the natural reward of individual labour. Each labourer produces only some part of a whole, and each part having no value or utility in itself, there is nothing on which the labourer can seize and say, "It is my product. This I will keep to myself." Labour Defended Against the Claims of Capital, 1825. The author of this admirable work is the Thomas Hodgkin I have already cited. End of footnote. It is only the common product of all the detail labourers that becomes a commodity. Footnote. This distinction between division of labour in society and in manufacture was practically illustrated to the Yankees. One of the new taxes devised at Washington during the Civil War was the duty of 6% on all industrial products. Question. What is an industrial product? Answer of the legislature. A thing is produced when it is made, and it is made when it is ready for sale. Now, for one example out of many, the New York and Philadelphia manufacturers had previously been in the habit of making umbrellas with all their belongings. But since an umbrella is a mixtum compositum of very heterogeneous parts, by degrees these parts became the products of various separate industries carried on independently in different places. They entered as separate commodities into the umbrella manufactory, where they were fitted together. The Yankees have given to articles thus fitted together the name of assembled articles, a name they deserve for being an assemblage of taxes. Thus the umbrella assembles first 6% on the price of each of its elements, and a further 6% on its own total price. End of footnote. Division of labour in society is brought about by the purchase and sale of the products of different branches of industry, while the connection between the detail operations in a workshop is due to the sale of the labour power of several workmen to one capitalist, who applies it as combined labour power. The division of labour in the workshop implies concentration of the means of production in the hands of one capitalist. The division of labour in society implies their dispersion among many independent producers of commodities. While within the workshop the iron law of proportionality subjects definite numbers of workmen to definite functions, in the society outside the workshop, chance and caprice have full play in distributing the producers and their means of production among the various branches of industry. The different spheres of production, it is true, constantly tend to an equilibrium, for, on the one hand, while each producer of a commodity is bound to produce a use value to satisfy a particular social want, and while the extent of these wants differs quantitatively, still there exists an inner relation which settles their proportions into a regular system, and that system one of spontaneous growth. And on the other hand, the law of the value of commodities ultimately determines how much of its disposable working time society can expend on each particular class of commodities. But this constant tendency to equilibrium of the various spheres of production is exercised only in the shape of a reaction against the constant upsetting of this equilibrium. The a priori system on which the division of labour within the workshop is regularly carried out becomes in the division of labour within the society an a posteriori, nature-imposed necessity, controlling the lawless caprice of the producers and perceptible in the barometrical fluctuations of the market prices. Division of labour within the workshop implies the undisputed authority of the capitalist over men, that are but parts of a mechanism that belongs to him. The division of labour within the society brings into contact independent commodity producers, who acknowledge no other authority but that of competition, of the coercion exerted by the pressure of their mutual interests. Just as in the animal kingdom, the bellum omnium contra omnes, war of all against all, Hobbes, more or less preserves the conditions of existence of every species. The same bourgeois mind which praises division of labour in the workshop, lifelong annexation of the labourer to a partial operation, and his complete subjection to capital as being an organisation of labour that increases its productiveness, that same bourgeois mind denounces with equal vigour every conscious attempt to socially control and regulate the process of production as an inroad upon such sacred things as the rights of property, freedom, and unrestricted play for the bent of the individual capitalist. It is very characteristic that the enthusiastic apologists of the factory system have nothing more damning to urge against a general organisation of the labour of society than that it would turn all society into one immense factory. If, in a society with capitalist production, anarchy in the social division of labour and despotism in that of the workshop are mutual conditions the one of the other, we find, on the contrary, in those earlier forms of society in which the separation of trades has been spontaneously developed, then crystallized, and finally made permanent by law, on the one hand, a specimen of the organization of the labor of society in accordance with an approved and authoritative plan, and on the other, the entire exclusion of division of labor in the workshop, or at all events a mere dwarf-like or sporadic and accidental development of the same. Footnote. It can be laid down as a general rule that the less authority presides over the division of labour inside society, the more the division of labour develops inside the workshop, and the more it is subjected there to the authority of a single person. Thus, authority in the workshop and authority in society in relation to the division of labour are in inverse ratio to each other. Karl Marx, misère, etc. End of footnote. Those small and extremely ancient Indian communities, some of which have continued down to this day, are based on possession in common of the land, on the blending of agriculture and handicrafts, and on an unalterable division of labour, which serves, whenever a new community is started, as a plan and scheme ready cut and dried. Occupying areas of from 100 up to several thousand acres, each forms a compact whole, producing all it requires. The chief part of the products is destined for direct use by the community itself and does not take the form of a commodity. Hence, production here is independent of that division of labour brought about in Indian society as a whole by means of the exchange of commodities. It is the surplus alone that becomes a commodity, and a portion of even that, not until it has reached the hands of the state, into whose hands, from time immemorial, a certain quantity of these products has found its way in the shape of rent in kind. The constitution of these communities varies in different parts of India. In those of the simplest form, the land is tilled in common, and the produce divided among the members. At the same time, spinning and weaving are carried on in each family as subsidiary industries. Side by side with the masses thus occupied with one and the same work, we find the chief inhabitant, who is judge, police, and tax-gatherer in one, the bookkeeper, who keeps the accounts of the tillage and registers everything relating thereto, another official, who prosecutes criminals, protects strangers travelling through, and escorts them to the next village, the boundary man, who guards the boundaries against neighbouring communities, the water overseer, who distributes the water from the common tanks for irrigation, the Brahmin, who conducts the religious services, the schoolmaster, who on the sand teaches the children reading and writing, the calendar Brahmin, or astrologer, who makes known the lucky or unlucky days for seed time and harvest and for every other kind of agricultural work, a smith and a carpenter who make and repair all the agricultural implements, the potter, who makes all the pottery of the village, the barber, the washerman, who washes clothes, the silversmith, here and there the poet, who in some communities replaces the silversmith, in others the schoolmaster. This dozen of individuals is maintained at the expense of the whole community. If the population increases, a new community is founded, on the pattern of the old one, on unoccupied land. The whole mechanism discloses a systematic division of labour, but a division like that in manufactures is impossible, since the smith and the carpenter, etc., find an unchanging market, and at the most there occur, according to the sizes of the villages, two or three of each instead of one. Footnote. Lieutenant Colonel Mark Wilkes, Historical Sketches of the South of India, 1810. A good description of the various forms of the Indian communities is to be found in George Campbell's Modern India, 1852, end of footnote. The law that regulates the division of labour in the community acts with the irresistible authority of a law of nature, at the same time that each individual artificer, the smith, the carpenter, and so on, conducts in his workshop all the operations of his handicraft in the traditional way, but independently, and without recognizing any authority over him. The simplicity of the organization for producing in these self-sufficing communities that constantly reproduce themselves in the same form, and when accidentally destroyed, spring up again, on the spot and with the same name. Footnote. Under this simple form, the inhabitants of the country have lived from time immemorial. The boundaries of the villages have been but seldom altered, and though the villages themselves have been sometimes injured, and even desolated, by war, famine, and disease, the same name, the same limits, the same interests, and even the same families have continued for ages. The inhabitants give themselves no trouble about the breaking up and division of kingdoms, While the village remains entire, they care not to what power it is transferred, or to what sovereign it devolves. Its internal economy remains unchanged. Thomas Stanford Raffles, the late Lieutenant Governor of Java. The History of Java, 1817. End of footnote. This simplicity supplies the key to the secret of the unchangeableness of Asiatic societies, an unchangeableness in such striking contrast with the constant dissolution and refounding of Asiatic states, and the never-ceasing changes of dynasty. The structure of the economic elements of society remains untouched by the storm clouds of the political sky. The rules of the guilds, as I have said before, by limiting most strictly the number of apprentices and journeymen that a single master could employ, prevented him from becoming a capitalist. Moreover, he could not employ his journeymen in many other handicrafts than the one in which he was a master. The guilds zealously repelled every encroachment by the capital of merchants, the only form of free capital with which they came in contact. A merchant could buy every kind of commodity, but labour as a commodity he could not buy. He existed only on sufferance, as a dealer in the products of the handicrafts. If circumstances called for a further division of labour, the existing guilds split themselves up into varieties, or founded new guilds by the side of the old ones. All this, however, without concentrating various handicrafts in a single workshop. Hence, the guild organisation, however much it may have contributed by separating, isolating, and perfecting the handicrafts to create the material conditions for the existence of manufacture, excluded division of labour in the workshop. On the whole, the labourer and his means of production remained closely united, like the snail with its shell, and thus there was wanting the principal basis of manufacture, the separation of the labourer from his means of production, and the conversion of these means into capital. While division of labour in society at large, whether such division be brought about or not by exchange of commodities, is common to economic formations of society the most diverse, division of labour in the workshop, as practised by manufacture, is a special creation of the capitalist mode of production alone. Section 5. The Capitalistic Character of Manufacture. An increased number of labourers under the control of one capitalist is the natural starting point, as well as of cooperation generally, as of manufacture in particular. But the division of labour in manufacture makes this increase in the number of workmen a technical necessity. The minimum number that any given capitalist is bound to employ is here prescribed by the previously established division of labour. On the other hand, the advantages of further division are obtainable only by adding to the number of workmen, and this can be done only by adding multiples of the various detail groups. But an increase in the variable component of the capital employed necessitates an increase in its constant component too, in the workshops, implements, etc., and in particular in the raw material, the call for which grows quicker than the number of workmen. The quantity of it consumed in a given time by a given amount of labour increases in the same ratio as does the productive power of that labour in consequence of its division. Hence, it is a law, based on the very nature of manufacture, that the minimum amount of capital, which is bound to be in the hands of each capitalist, must keep increasing. In other words, that the transformation into capital of the social means of production and subsistence must keep extending. Footnote. It is not sufficient that the capital, the writer should have said, the necessary means of subsistence and of production, required for the subdivision of handicrafts should be in readiness in the society. It must also be accumulated in the hands of the employers in sufficiently large quantities to enable them to conduct their operations on a large scale. The more the division increases, the more does the constant employment of a given number of labourers require a greater outlay of capital in tools, raw material, etc. Storch, Cours d'économie politique. The concentration of the instruments of production and the division of labour are as inseparable one from the other as are in the political sphere the concentration of public powers and the division of private interests. Karl Marx. End of footnote. In manufacture, as well as in simple cooperation, the collective working organism is a form of existence of capital. The mechanism that is made up of numerous individual detail labourers belongs to the capitalist. Hence, the productive power resulting from a combination of labours appears to be the productive power of capital. Manufacture proper not only subjects the previously independent workman to the discipline and command of capital, but, in addition, creates a hierarchic gradation of the workmen themselves. While simple cooperation leaves the mode of working by the individual for the most part unchanged, manufacture thoroughly revolutionizes it and seizes labour power by its very roots. It converts the labourer into a crippled monstrosity by forcing his detailed dexterity at the expense of a world of productive capabilities and instincts. Just as in the states of La Plata they butcher a whole beast for the sake of his hide or his tallow. Not only is the detail work distributed to the different individuals, but the individual himself is made the automatic motor of a fractional operation. Footnote. Dougal Stewart calls manufacturing labourers living automatons employed in the details of the work. End of footnote. And the absurd fable of Menenius Agrippa, which makes man a mere fragment of his own body, becomes realised. Footnote. In corals, each individual is, in fact, the stomach of the whole group, but it supplies the group with nourishment instead of, like the Roman patrician, withdrawing it. End of footnote. If at first the workman sells his labour power to capital because the material means of producing a commodity fail him, now his very labour power refuses its services unless it has been sold to capital. Its functions can be exercised only in an environment that exists in the workshop of the capitalist after the sale. By nature unfitted to make anything independently, the manufacturing labourer develops productive activity as a mere appendage of the capitalist's workshop. Footnote. The worker who is the master of a whole craft can work and find the means of subsistence anywhere. The other, the manufacturing labourer, is only an appendage who, when he is separated from his fellows, possesses neither capability nor independence, and finds himself forced to accept any law it is thought fit to impose. Storch, 1815. End of footnote. As the chosen people bore in their features the sign manual of Jehovah, so division of labour brands the manufacturing workman as the property of capital. The knowledge, the judgment, and the will, which, though in ever so small a degree, are practised by the independent peasant or handicraftsman, in the same way as the savage makes the whole art of war consist in the exercise of his personal cunning, these faculties are now required only for the workshop as a whole. Intelligence in production expands in one direction because it vanishes in many others. What is lost by the detail labourers is concentrated in the capital that employs them. Footnote. A. Ferguson. The former may have gained what the other has lost. End of footnote. It is a result of the division of labour in manufactures that the labourer is brought face to face with the intellectual potencies of the material process of production, as the property of another, and as a ruling power. This separation, begins in simple cooperation, where the capitalist represents to the single workman the oneness and the will of the associated labour. It is developed in manufacture, which cuts down the labourer into a detail labourer. It is completed in modern industry, which makes science a productive force distinct from labour and presses it into the service of capital. Footnote. The man of knowledge and the productive labourer come to be widely divided from each other, and knowledge, instead of remaining the handmaid of labour in the hand of the labourer to increase his productive powers, has almost everywhere arrayed itself against labour, systematically deluding and leading them, the labourers, astray in order to render their muscular powers entirely mechanical and obedient. W. Thompson, An Inquiry into the Principles of the Distribution of Wealth. London, 1824. End of footnote. In manufacture, in order to make the collective labourer, and through him, capital, rich in social productive power, each labourer must be made poor in individual productive powers. Ignorance is the mother of industry as well as of superstition. Reflection and fancy are subject to error, but a habit of moving the hand or the foot is independent of either. Manufactures, accordingly, prosper most where the mind is least consulted, and where the workshop may be considered as an engine, the parts of which are men. Footnote. A. Ferguson. End of footnote. As a matter of fact, some few manufacturers in the middle of the 18th century preferred, for certain operations that were trade secrets, to employ half-idiotic persons. Footnote. J.D. Tuckett, A History of the Past and Present State of the Labouring Population, 1846. End of footnote. The understandings of the greater part of men, says Adam Smith, are necessarily formed by their ordinary employments. The man whose whole life is spent in performing a few simple operations has no occasion to exert his understanding. He generally becomes as stupid and ignorant as it is possible for a human creature to become. After describing the stupidity of the detail labourer, he goes on, "The uniformity of his stationary life naturally corrupts the courage of his mind. It corrupts even the activity of his body, and renders him incapable of exerting his strength with vigour and perseverance in any other employments than that to which he has been bred. His dexterity at his own particular trade seems in this manner to be acquired at the expense of his intellectual, social, and martial virtues. But in every improved and civilized society, this is the state into which the labouring poor, that is, the great body of the people, must necessarily fall." Footnote. A. Smith, Wealth of Nations. Being a pupil of A. Ferguson, who showed the disadvantageous effects of division of labour, Adam Smith was perfectly clear on this point. In the introduction to his work, where he ex professo praises division of labour, he indicates only in a cursory manner that it is the source of social inequalities. It is not till the fifth book, On the Revenue of the State, that he reproduces Ferguson. In my Misère de la Philosophie, I have sufficiently explained the historical connection between Ferguson, A. Smith, Lemontey, and Say, as regards their criticisms of division of labour, and have shown for the first time that division of labour as practised in manufactures is a specific form of the capitalist mode of production. End of footnote. For preventing the complete deterioration of the great mass of the people by division of labour, A. Smith recommends education of the people by the state, but prudently, and in homeopathic doses. G. Garnier, his French translator and commentator, who, under the First French Empire, quite naturally developed into a senator, quite as naturally opposes him on this point. "Education of the masses," he urges, "violates the first law of the division of labour, and with it, Our whole social system would be proscribed. Like all other divisions of labour, he says that between hand labour and head labour is more pronounced and decided in proportion as society, he rightly uses this word for capital, landed property and their state, becomes richer. Footnote. Ferguson had already said, and thinking itself in this age of separations may become a peculiar craft. End of footnote. This division of labour, like every other, is an effect of past and a cause of future progress. Ought the government, then, to work in opposition to this division of labour and to hinder its natural course? Ought it to expend a part of the public money in the attempt to confound and blend together two classes of labour which are striving after division and separation? Some crippling of body and mind is inseparable even from division of labour in society as a whole. Since, however, manufacture carries this social separation of branches of labour much further, and also, by its peculiar division, attacks the individual at the very roots of his life, it is the first to afford the materials for, and to give a start to, industrial pathology. Footnote. Ramazzini, professor of practical medicine at Padua, published in 1713 his work De Morbis Artificum, which was translated into French 1781, reprinted 1841 in the Encyclopédie des Sciences Médicales. The period of modern mechanical industry has, of course, very much enlarged his catalogue of labour's diseases. In 1854, the Society of Arts appointed a commission of inquiry into industrial pathology. The list of documents collected by this commission is to be seen in the catalogue of the Twickenham Economic Museum. Very important are the official reports on public health. End of footnote. To subdivide a man is to execute him if he deserves the sentence, to assassinate him if he does not. The subdivision of labour is the assassination of a people. Footnote. D. Urquhart, Familiar Words, 1855. Hegel held very heretical views on division of labour. In his Rechtsphilosophie, he says, "By well-educated men we understand, in the first instance, those who can do everything that others do." End of footnote. Cooperation based on division of labour, in other words, manufacture, commences as a spontaneous formation. So soon as it attains some consistence and extension, it becomes the recognised methodical and systematic form of capitalist production. History shows how the division of labour peculiar to manufacture, strictly so called, acquires the best adapted form at first by experience, as it were, behind the backs of the actors, and then, like the guild handicrafts, strives to hold fast that form when once found, and here and there succeeds in keeping it for centuries. Any alteration in this form, except in trivial matters, is solely owing to a revolution in the instruments of labour. Modern manufacture, whenever it arises, I do not here allude to modern industry based on machinery, either finds the disjecta membra poetae ready to hand and only waiting to be collected together, as is the case in the manufacture of clothes in large towns, or it can easily apply the principle of division, simply by exclusively assigning the various operations of a handicraft, such as bookbinding, to particular men. In such cases, a week's experience is enough to determine the proportion between the numbers of the hands necessary for the various functions. Footnote. The simple belief in the inventive genius exercised a priori by the individual capitalist in division of labour exists nowadays only among German professors of the stamp of Herr Roche, who, to recompense the capitalist from whose Jovian head division of labour sprang ready-formed, dedicates to him various wages, diverse Arbeitslöhne. The more or less extensive application of division of labour depends on length of purse, not on greatness of genius. End of footnote. By decomposition of handcrafts, by specialisation of the instruments of labour, by the formation of detail labourers, and by grouping and combining the latter into a single mechanism, division of labour in manufacture creates a qualitative gradation and a quantitative proportion in the social process of production. It consequently creates a definite organisation of the labour of society, and thereby develops at the same time new productive forces in the society. In its specific capitalist form, and under the given conditions, it could take no other form than a capitalistic one. Manufacture is but a particular method of begetting relative surplus value, or of augmenting at the expense of the labourer the self-expansion of capital, usually called social wealth, wealth of nations, etc. It increases the social productive power of labour, not only for the benefit of the capitalist instead of for that of the labourer, but it does this by crippling the individual labourers. It creates new conditions for the lordship of capital over labour. If, therefore, on the one hand, it presents itself historically as a progress and a necessary phase in the economic development of society, on the other hand, it is a refined and civilized method of exploitation. Political economy, which, as an independent science, first sprang into being during the period of manufacture, views the social division of labour only from the standpoint of manufacture, and sees in it only the means of producing more commodities with a given quantity of labour, and consequently of cheapening commodities and hurrying on the accumulation of capital. Footnote. The older writers, like Petty and the anonymous author of Advantages of the East India Trade, bring out the capitalist character of division of labour as applied in manufacture more than A. Smith does. End of footnote. In most striking contrast with this accentuation of quantity and exchange value is the attitude of the writers of classical antiquity, who hold exclusively by quality and use value. Footnote. Amongst the moderns may be excepted a few writers of the 18th century, like Beccaria and James Harris, who with regard to division of labour almost entirely follow the ancients. Thus Beccaria. Everyone knows from experience that if the hands and the intelligence are always applied to the same kind of work and the same products, these will be produced more easily, in greater abundance, and in higher quality, than if each individual makes for himself all the things he needs. In this way, men are divided up into various classes and conditions, to their own advantage and to that of the commodity. James Harris, afterwards Earl of Malmesbury, celebrated for the diaries of his embassy at St. Petersburg, says in a note to his Dialogue Concerning Happiness, 1741, reprinted afterwards in Three Treaties, 1772, "The whole argument to prove society natural, that is, by division of employments, is taken from the second book of Plato's Republic." End of footnote. In consequence of the separation of the social branches of production, commodities are better made. The various bents and talents of men select a suitable field. Footnote. Thus in the Odyssey, "For different men take joy in different works," and Archilochus in Sextus Empiricus, "Men differ as to things cheer their hearts." End of footnote. "And without some restraint, no important results can be obtained anywhere." Footnote. "He could do many works, but all of them badly." Homer. Every Athenian considered himself superior as a producer of commodities to a Spartan, for the latter in time of war had men enough at his disposal, but could not command money. As Thucydides makes Pericles say in the speech inciting the Athenians to the Peloponnesian War, "People producing for their own consumption will rather let war have their bodies than their money. Nevertheless, even with regard to material production, self-sufficiency, as opposed to division of labour, remained their ideal. For with the latter there is well-being, but with the former there is independence. It should be mentioned here that at the date of the fall of the 30 tyrants, there were still not 5,000 Athenians without landed property. End of footnote. Hence both product and producer are improved by division of labour. If the growth of the quantity produced is occasionally mentioned, this is only done with reference to the greater abundance of use values. There is not a word alluding to exchange value or to the cheapening of commodities. This aspect, from the standpoint of use value alone, is taken as well by Plato, who treats division of labour as the foundation on which the division of society into classes is based, as by Xenophon, who with characteristic bourgeois instinct approaches more nearly to division of labour within the workshop. Footnote. With Plato, division of labour within the community is a development from the multifarious requirements and the limited capacities of individuals. The main point with him is that the labourer must adapt himself to the work, not the work to the labourer, which latter is unavoidable if he carries on several trades at once, thus making one or the other of them subordinate. For the workman must wait upon the work, it will not wait upon his leisure and allow itself to be done in a spare moment. Yes, he must. So the conclusion is that more will be produced of everything, and the work will be more easily and better done, when every man is set free from all other occupations to do at the right time the one thing for which he is naturally fitted. So in Thucydides, seafaring is an art like any other, and cannot, as circumstances require, be carried on as a subsidiary occupation. Nay, other subsidiary occupations cannot be carried on alongside of this one. If the work, says Plato, has to wait for the labourer, the critical point in the process is missed and the article spoiled. If someone lets slip... The same Platonic idea is found recurring in the protest of the English bleachers against the clause in the Factory Act that provides fixed meal times for all operatives. Their business cannot wait the convenience of the workmen, for, in the various operations of singeing, washing, bleaching, mangling, calendaring, and dyeing, none of them can be stopped at a given moment without risk of damage. To enforce the same dinner hour for all the workpeople might occasionally subject valuable goods to the risk of danger by incomplete operations. Where will Platonism be found next? Xenophon says, "It is not only an honour to receive food from the table of the king of Persia, but such food is much more tasty than other food. And there is nothing wonderful in this, for as the other arts are brought to special perfection in the great towns, so the royal food is prepared in a special way. For in the small towns the same man makes bedsteads, doors, ploughs, and tables. Often, too, he builds houses into the bargain, and is quite content if he finds custom sufficient for his sustenance. It is altogether impossible for a man who does so many things to do them all well. But in the great towns, where each can find many buyers, one trade is sufficient to maintain the man who carries it on. Nay, there is often not even need of one complete trade, but one man makes shoes for men, another for women. Here and there, one man gets a living by sewing, another by cutting out shoes. One does nothing but cut out clothes, another nothing but sew the pieces together. It follows necessarily, then, that he who does the simplest kind of work undoubtedly does it better than anyone else. So it is with the art of cooking. Xenophon here lays stress exclusively upon the excellence to be attained in use value, although he well knows that the gradations of the division of labour depend on the extent of the market. End of footnote. Plato's Republic, in so far as division of labour is treated in it, as the formative principle of the state, is merely the Athenian idealization of the Egyptian system of castes, Egypt having served as the model of an industrial country to many of his contemporaries also, amongst others to Isocrates, and it continued to have this importance to the Greeks of the Roman Empire. Footnote. Busiris divided them all into special castes, commanded that the same individuals should always carry on the same trade, for he knew that they who change their occupations become skilled in none, but that those who constantly stick to one occupation bring it to the highest perfection. In truth, we shall also find that in relation to the arts and handicrafts, they have outstripped their rivals more than a master does a bungler, and the contrivances for maintaining the monarchy and the other institutions of their state are so admirable that the most celebrated philosophers who treat of this subject praise the constitution of the Egyptian state above all others. End of footnote. During the manufacturing period proper, that is, the period during which manufacture is the predominant form taken by capitalist production, many obstacles are opposed to the full development of the peculiar tendencies of manufacture. Although manufacture creates, as we have already seen, a simple separation of the labourers into skilled and unskilled, simultaneously with their hierarchic arrangement in classes, yet the number of the unskilled labourers, owing to the preponderating influence of the skilled, remains very limited. Although it adapts the detail operations to the various degrees of maturity, strength, and development of the living instruments of labour, thus conducing to exploitation of women and children, yet this tendency as a whole is wrecked on the habits and the resistance of the male labourers. Although the splitting up of handicrafts lowers the cost of forming the workman, and thereby lowers his value, yet for the more difficult detail work, a longer apprenticeship is necessary, and even where it would be superfluous, is jealously insisted upon by the workmen. In England, for instance, we find the laws of apprenticeship, with their 7 years probation, in full force down to the end of the manufacturing period, and they are not thrown on one side till the advent of modern industry. Since handicraft skill is the foundation of manufacture, and since the mechanism of manufacture as a whole possesses no framework, apart from the labourers themselves, capital is constantly compelled to wrestle with the insubordination of the workmen. By the infirmity of human nature, says friend Ure, it happens that the more skilful the workman, the more self-willed and intractable he is apt to become, and of course the less fit a component of a mechanical system in which he may do great damage to the whole. Hence, throughout the whole manufacturing period, there runs the complaint of want of discipline among the workmen. Footnote. This is more the case in England than in France, and more in France than in Holland. End of footnote. And had we not the testimony of contemporary writers, the simple facts that during the period between the 16th century and the epoch of modern industry, capital failed to become the master of the whole disposable working time of the manufacturing labourers, that manufactures are short-lived and change their locality from one country to another with the emigrating or immigrating workmen, these facts would speak volumes. "Order must in one way or another be established," exclaims in 1770 the oft-cited author of the Essay on Trade and Commerce. "Order," re-echoes Dr. Andrew Ure 66 years later, "order was wanting in manufacture based on the scholastic dogma of division of labour and Arkwright created order." At the same time, manufacture was unable either to seize upon the production of society to its full extent, or to revolutionize that production to its very core. It towered up as an economic work of art, on the broad foundation of the town handicrafts and of the rural domestic industries. At a given stage in its development, the narrow technical basis on which manufacture rested came into conflict with requirements of production that were created by manufacture itself. One of its most finished creations was the workshop for the production of the instruments of labour themselves, including especially the complicated mechanical apparatus then already employed. A machine factory, says Ure, displayed the division of labour in manifold gradations, the file, the drill, the lathe, having each its different workmen, in the order of skill. This workshop, the production of the division of labour in manufacture, produced in its turn machines. It is they that sweep away the handicraftsman's work as the regulating principle of social production. Thus, on the one hand, the technical reason for the lifelong annexation of the workman to a detail function is removed. On the other hand, the fetters that this same principle laid on the dominion of capital fall away. Chapter 15. Machinery and Modern Industry. Section 1. The Development of Machinery. John Stuart Mill says in his Principles of Political Economy, "It is questionable if all the mechanical inventions yet made have lightened the day's toil of any human being." Footnote. Mill should have said, "Of any human being not fed by other people's labour, for without doubt, machinery has greatly increased the number of well-to-do idlers." That is, however, by no means the aim of the capitalistic application of machinery. Like every other increase in the productiveness of labour, machinery is intended to cheapen commodities, and by shortening that portion of the working day in which the labourer works for himself, to lengthen the other portion that he gives without an equivalent to the capitalist. In short, it is a means for producing surplus value. In manufacture, the revolution in the mode of production begins with the labour power. In modern industry, it begins with the instruments of labour. Our first inquiry, then, is how the instruments of labour are converted from tools into machines. Or what is the difference between a machine and the implements of a handicraft? We are only concerned here with striking and general characteristics, for epochs in the history of society are no more separated from each other by hard and fast lines of demarcation than are geological epochs. Mathematicians and mechanicians, and in this they are followed by a few English economists, call a tool a simple machine, and a machine a complex tool. They see no essential difference between them, and even give the name of machine to the simple mechanical powers, the lever, the inclined plane, the screw, the wedge, etc. Footnote. See, for instance, Hutton, Course of Mathematics. End of footnote. As a matter of fact, every machine is a combination of those simple powers, no matter how they may be disguised. From the economic standpoint, this explanation is worth nothing, because the historical element is wanting. Another explanation of the difference between tool and machine is that in the case of a tool, man is the motive power, while the motive power of a machine is something different from man, as, for instance, an animal, water, wind, and so on. Footnote. From this point of view, we may draw a sharp line of distinction between a tool and a machine. Spades, hammers, chisels, etc., combinations of levers and of screws, in all of which, no matter how complicated they may be in other respects, man is the motive power. All this falls under the idea of a tool, but the plough, which is drawn by animal power and windmills, etc., must be classed among machines. Wilhelm Schultz, Die Bewegung der Produktion, Zürich, 1843. In many respects, a book to be recommended. End of footnote. According to this, A plough drawn by oxen, which is a contrivance common to the most different epochs, would be a machine, while Clausen's circular loom, which, worked by a single labourer, weaves 96,000 picks per minute, would be a mere tool. Nay, this very loom, though a tool when worked by hand, would, if worked by steam, be a machine. And since the application of animal power is one of man's earliest inventions, production by machinery would have preceded production by handicrafts. When in 1735 John Wyatt brought out his spinning machine and began the industrial revolution of the 18th century, not a word did he say about an ass driving it instead of a man, and yet this part fell to the ass. He described it as a machine to spin without fingers. Footnote. Before his time, spinning machines, although very imperfect ones, had already been used, and Italy was probably the country of their first appearance. A critical history of technology would show us how little any of the inventions of the 18th century are the work of a single individual. Hitherto, there is no such book. Darwin has interested us in the history of nature's technology, that is, in the formation of the organs of plants and animals, which organs serve as instruments of production for sustaining life. Does not the history of the productive organs of man, of organs that are the material basis of all social organization, deserve equal attention? And would not such a history be easier to compile, since, as Vico says, human history differs from natural history in this, that we have made the former, but not the latter? Technology discloses man's mode of dealing with nature, the process of production by which he sustains his life, and thereby also lays bare the mode of formation of his social relations and of the mental conceptions that flow from them. Every history of religion, even, that fails to take account of this material basis is uncritical. It is, in reality, much easier to discover by analysis the earthly core of the misty creations of religion than, conversely, it is to develop from the actual relations of life the corresponding celestialized forms of those relations. The latter method is the only materialistic, and therefore the only scientific one. The weak points in the abstract materialism of natural science, a materialism that excludes history and its process, are at once evident from the abstract and ideological conceptions of its spokesmen, whenever they venture beyond the bounds of their own speciality. End of footnote. All fully developed machinery consists of three essentially different parts: the motor mechanism, the transmitting mechanism, and finally the tool or working machine. The motor mechanism is that which puts the whole in motion. It either generates its own motive power, like the steam engine, the caloric engine, the electromagnetic machine, etc., or it receives its impulse from some already existing natural force, like the water wheel from a head of water, the windmill from wind, etc. The transmitting mechanism, composed of flywheels, shafting, toothed wheels, pulleys, straps, ropes, bands, pinions, and gearing of the most varied kinds, regulates the motion, changes its form where necessary, as, for instance, from linear to circular, and divides and distributes it among the working machines. These two first parts of the whole mechanism are there solely for putting the working machines in motion, by means of which motion the subject of labour is seized upon and modified as desired. The tool or working machine is that part of the machinery with which the industrial revolution of the 18th century started, and to this day it constantly serves as such a starting point whenever a handicraft or a manufacture is turned into an industry carried on by machinery. On a closer examination of the working machine proper, we find in it, as a general rule, though often no doubt under very altered forms, the apparatus and tools used by the handicraftsman or manufacturing workman, with this difference, that instead of being human implements, they are the implements of a mechanism, or mechanical implements. Either the entire machine is only a more or less altered mechanical edition of the old handicraft tool, as, for instance, the power loom, or the working parts fitted in the frame of the machine are old acquaintances, as spindles are in a mule, needles in a stocking loom, saws in a sawing machine, and knives in a chopping machine. Footnote. Especially in the original form of the power loom, we recognize, at the first glance, the ancient loom. In its modern form, the power loom has undergone essential alterations. End of footnote. The distinction between these tools and the body proper of the machine exists from their very birth, for they continue for the most part to be produced by handicraft or by manufacture, and are afterwards fitted into the body of the machine, which is the product of machinery. Footnote. It is only during the last 15 years, that is, since about 1850, that a constantly increasing portion of these machine tools have been made in England by machinery, and that not by the same manufacturers who make the machines. Instances of machines for the fabrication of these mechanical tools are the automatic bobbin-making engine, the card-setting engine, shuttle-making machines, and machines for forging mule and throstle spindles. End of footnote. The machine proper is therefore a machine that, after being set in motion, performs with its tools the same operations that were formerly done by the workman with similar tools. Whether the motive power is derived from man or from some other machine makes no difference in this respect. From the moment that the tool proper is taken from man and fitted into a mechanism, a machine takes the place of a mere implement. The difference strikes one at once, even in those cases where man himself continues to be the prime mover. The number of implements that he himself can use simultaneously is limited by the number of his own natural instruments of production, by the number of his bodily organs. In Germany, they tried at first to make one spinner work two spinning wheels, that is, to work simultaneously with both hands and both feet. This was too difficult. Later, a treadle spinning wheel with two spindles was invented, but adepts in spinning, who could spin two threads at once, were almost as scarce as two-headed men. The jenny, on the other hand, even at its very birth, spun with 12 to 18 spindles, and the stocking loom knits with many thousand needles at once. The number of tools that a machine can bring into play simultaneously is from the very first emancipated from the organic limits that hedge in the tools of a handicraftsman. In many manual implements, the distinction between man as mere motive power and man as the workman, or operator properly so called, is brought into striking contrast. For instance, the foot is merely the prime mover of the spinning wheel, while the hand, working with the spindle and drawing and twisting, performs the real operation of spinning. It is this last part of the handicraftsman's implement that is first seized upon by the Industrial Revolution, leaving to the workman, in addition to his new labour of watching the machine with his eyes and correcting its mistakes with his hands, the merely mechanical part of being the moving power. On the other hand, implements, in regard to which man has always acted as a simple motive power, as, for instance, by turning the crank of a mill, by pumping, by moving up and down the arm of a bellows, by pounding with a mortar, etc., such implements soon call for the application of animals, water, and wind as motive powers. Footnote. Moses says, "Thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treads the corn." The Christian philanthropists of Germany, on the contrary, fastened a wooden board round the necks of the serfs, whom they used as a motive power for grinding, in order to prevent them from putting flour into their mouths with their hands. End of footnote. Here and there, long before the period of manufacture, and also to some extent during that period, these implements pass over into machines, but without creating any revolution in the mode of production. Footnote. It was partly the want of streams with a good fall on them, and partly their battles with a superabundance of water in other respects, that compelled the Dutch to resort to wind as a motive power. The windmill itself they got from Germany, where its invention was the origin of a pretty squabble between the nobles, the priests, and the emperor, as to which of those three the wind belonged. "The air makes bondage," was the cry in Germany, at the same time that the wind was making Holland free. What it reduced to bondage, in this case, was not the Dutchman, but the land for the Dutchman. In 1836, 12,000 windmills of 6,000 horsepower were still employed in Holland to prevent two-thirds of the land from being reconverted into morasses. End of footnote. It becomes evident, in the period of modern industry, that these implements, even under their form of manual tools, are already machines. For instance, the pumps with which the Dutch, in 1836-7, emptied the Lake of Haarlem, were constructed on the principle of ordinary pumps, the only difference being that their pistons were driven by cyclopean steam machines instead of by men. The common and very imperfect bellows of the blacksmith is, in England, occasionally converted into a blowing engine by connecting its arm with a steam engine. The steam engine itself, such as it was at its invention during the manufacturing period at the close of the 17th century, and such as it continued to be down to 1780, did not give rise to any industrial revolution. Footnote. It was indeed very much improved by Watt's first so-called single-acting engine, but in this form it continued to be a mere machine for raising water and the liquor from salt mines. End of footnote. It was, on the contrary, the invention of machines that made a revolution in the form of steam engines necessary. As soon as man, instead of working with an implement on the subject of his labour, becomes merely the motive power of an implement machine, it is a mere accident that motive power takes the disguise of human muscle, and it may equally well take the form of wind, water, or steam. Of course, this does not prevent such a change of form from producing great technical alterations in the mechanism that was originally constructed to be driven by man alone. Nowadays, all machines that have their way to make, such as sewing machines, bread-making machines, etc., are, unless from their very nature their use on a small scale is excluded, constructed to be driven both by human and by purely mechanical motive power. The machine, which is the starting point of the Industrial Revolution, supersedes the workman, who handles a single tool, by a mechanism operating with a number of similar tools, and set in motion by a single motive power, whatever the form of that power may be. Footnote. The union of all these simple instruments, set in motion by a single motor, constitutes a machine. Babbage. End of footnote. Here we have the machine, but only as an elementary factor of production by machinery. Increase in the size of the machine, and in the number of its working tools, calls for a more massive mechanism to drive it, and this mechanism requires, in order to overcome its resistance, a mightier moving power than that of man, apart from the fact that man is a very imperfect instrument for producing uniform continued motion. But assuming that he is acting simply as a motor, that a machine has taken the place of his tool, it is evident that he can be replaced by natural forces. of all the great motors handed down from the manufacturing period, horsepower is the worst, partly because a horse has a head of his own, partly because he is costly, and the extent to which he is applicable in factories is very restricted. Footnote. In January 1861, John C. Morton read before the Society of Arts a paper on the forces employed in agriculture. He there states, "Every improvement that furthers the uniformity of the land makes the steam engine more and more applicable to the production of pure mechanical force. Horsepower is requisite wherever crooked fences and other obstructions prevent uniform action. These obstructions are vanishing day by day. For operations that demand more exercise of will than actual force, the only power applicable is that controlled every instant by the human mind, in other words, manpower." Mr. Morton then reduces steam power, horsepower, and manpower to the unit in general use for steam engines, namely, the force required to raise 33,000 pounds, 1 foot in 1 minute, and reckons the cost of 1 horsepower from a steam engine to be threepence, and from a horse to be 5½ per hour. Further, if a horse must fully maintain its health, it can work no more than 8 hours a day. 3 at the least out of every 7 horses used on tillage land during the year can be dispensed with by using steam power at an expense not greater than that which the horses dispensed with would cost during the 3 or 4 months in which alone they can be used effectively. Lastly, steam power, in those agricultural operations in which it can be employed, improves, in comparison with horsepower, the quality of the work. To do the work of a steam engine would require 66 men, at a total cost of 15 shillings an hour, and to do the work of a horse 32 men, at a total cost of 8 shillings an hour. End of footnote. Nevertheless, the horse was extensively used during the infancy of modern industry. This is proved as well by the complaints of contemporary agriculturists as by the term horsepower, which has survived to this day as an expression for mechanical force. Wind was too inconstant and uncontrollable, and besides, in England, the birthplace of modern industry, the use of water power preponderated, even during the manufacturing period. In the 17th century, attempts had already been made to turn 2 pairs of millstones with a single water wheel, but the increased size of the gearing was too much for the water power, which had now become insufficient, and this was one of the circumstances that led to a more accurate investigation of the laws of friction. In the same way, the irregularity caused by the motive power in mills that were put in motion by pushing and pulling a lever led to the theory and the application of the flywheel, which afterwards plays so important a part in modern industry. Footnote. Faulhaber, 1625. De Caus, 1688. End of footnote. In this way, during the manufacturing period, were developed the first scientific and technical elements of modern mechanical industry. Arkwright's Throssell spinning mill was from the very first turned by water, but for all that, the use of water as the predominant motive power was beset with difficulties. It could not be increased at will, it failed at certain seasons of the year, and above all, it was essentially local. Footnote. The modern turbine frees the industrial exploitation of water power from many of its former fetters. End of footnote. Not till the invention of Watt's second and so-called double-acting steam engine was a prime mover found that begot its own force by the consumption of coal and water, whose power was entirely under man's control, that was mobile and a means of locomotion, that was urban and not like the water wheel rural, that permitted production to be concentrated in towns instead of, like the water wheels, being scattered up and down the country, that was of universal technical application and, relatively speaking, little affected in its choice of residence by local circumstances. Footnote. In the early days of textile manufactures, the locality of the factory depended upon the existence of a stream having a sufficient fall to turn a water wheel, and although the establishment of the water mills was the commencement of the breaking up of the domestic system of manufacture, yet the mills necessarily situated upon streams, and frequently at considerable distances the one from the other, formed part of a rural rather than an urban system, and it was not until the introduction of the steam power as a substitute for the stream that factories were congregated in towns, and localities where the coal and water required for the production of steam were found in sufficient quantities. The steam engine is the parent of manufacturing towns. A. Redgrave, in Reports of the Inspector of Factories, 30th of April, 1860. End of footnote. The greatness